Welcome back. It's the second hour of Issues Etc. Continuing audio open lines. And during this time, as time permits, we hope to get to a story from Fox News about gay civil unions in New Jersey. This is essentially gay marriage in New Jersey. Third state, I believe, to legalize gay marriage in some form or another. And then an ABC News report on the prospect of gay marriage in California. The issue will go before the California Supreme Court sometime in the near future. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Coming up in 25 minutes, we'll be talking with Nancy Gibbs. She's editor-at-large for Time Magazine. She's authored the cover story of Time Magazine this week called The Abortion Campaign You Never Heard About. It's about crisis pregnancy centers. We'll continue in the few minutes after our conversation with her, talking with representative both Concerned Women for America and Central Indiana Crisis Pregnancy Centers about what's being done here in the battle against abortion in crisis pregnancy centers. They come in for a lot of criticism, especially from the pro-choice organizations. So they get misinformation, they bully women, they scare women. We'll see if any of that is true coming up a little bit later in the program. Now, before the break, we heard this story out of New York City where they've decided that they're just going to give condoms away free. They've done this before, but now they're really pushing it as a campaign. It's called the NYC Condom. If I'm not mistaken, it's got special packaging, and they got a big fashion designer in help pushing this thing. They're going to want to give away almost 2 million a week. They say this is simply the government's interest in stemming the spread of sexually transmitted diseases and HIV/AIDS. And I asked before the break, I want your answer to this question. If the logic here is the same as we use for the government's interest in immunizing children, stemming the spread of those kind of diseases, where's the hole in the thinking? Where is this thinking wrong? Who says, look, this is in the government's interest to give away condoms because it helps stem the spread of disease. Our in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org, and our call-in numbers, 1-800-730-2727 or 505-7850. Marilyn writes from St. Louis. She says, we should not hand out free condoms to make sex safer, in quotations. Most people would not trust a condom to protect them if they knew for certain the partner had AIDS. Good point. They would instead not have sex with that person. Having multiple sex partners is now a dangerous activity. I would no more tell my son a condom would protect him that dangerous activity than I would tell my son to drive 120 miles per hour on the highway and just use his seatbelt. That's a great analogy. Who was that? Was that Marilyn? Great analogy. Yeah, kid. The safest thing to do while driving is wear your seatbelt. You know what's so good about that Maryland's analogy? It highlights the real difference here. And it's the difference that's at the heart of the Archbishop and the Bishop's objections in that piece we heard from CNN. Their objection was the one surefire way of not spreading STDs or AIDS is through sexual activity is, and the Catholic Church has honed this language to an art, is abstinence before marriage and faithfulness within marriage. That's how they talk about it, which is kind of a good policy. It's the general viewpoint of the Christian church on where sex belongs. I've never had a problem with the term safe sex, but I think it should be understood safe sex is abstinence before marriage, faithfulness in marriage. That's safe sex. It is. It has nothing to do with the use of condoms or anything like that. Just like, to use Marilyn's analogy, there's safe driving and there's unsafe driving. There's the kind of driving you should be doing, which is staying within the speed limit, and the kind of driving that you shouldn't be doing, which is exceeding the speed limit or driving in someone else's lane or going the wrong way or getting on the sidewalk. There's all sorts of ways to drive that are unsafe, even if you're wearing a seatbelt.
Once one of Don Matz's infamous lines.
What?
I'm preconceptually pro-choice.
what did good old Don mean by that?
that he's pro-choice before conception. You have a choice whether to, like, have sex and, you know, live with the consequences. And
yeah. I would simply say, you can say no. It is possible to say no. It's been done before. And as Rush Limbaugh likes to point out, abstinence is a safe sex policy that works every time it's tried.
Marilyn, once again, proving we have the smartest listeners in radio.
Absolutely. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. And our in-studio email address is issuesetc@kfuo.org. Before we get to this gay civil union in New Jersey, I'm a father of a teenage girl. So when you talk about these issues, it resonates with me in a way that I must say it never really did before I was the father of a teenage girl. And I would be talking about being a father of a teenage son if I had a teenage son. He's not a teenager yet. Someone says, look, the kids are going to have sex. Believe me, there are a lot of parents out there. I discover with much chagrin, there are a lot of parents out there who have resigned themselves to the fact that their kids are going to go out and have sex. They've resigned themselves to that fact. Or, as I would like to put it, they've given up on that issue. And they say, look, they're going to have sex anyway, so we might as well give them a means by which it can be as safe as possible. The analogy I've drawn, which I think Marilyn's outdone my analogy, but the analogy that I've used a lot is, heck, for that matter, let's apply that logic to guns. They're going to play with guns. They're going to play with firearms, whether you want them to or not. They're going to find a way, our teenagers, our young people, to have access to guns and to play with them, loaded firearms. So what we really ought to do is send them to firearm safety courses. Or buy them the safest possible guns that they could use, if they're going to play with guns anyway. Now, when you hear it put that way, don't you say, or to use Marilyn's analogy, they're going to drive 120 miles an hour anyway. We can't stop them. Let's just encourage them to wear their seatbelt. Do you see why I call that giving up? Drugs could be another one. Look, they're going to go out. They're going to use drugs. They're going to use all sorts of dangerous and illegal substances. Let's at least make sure that they get it from safe and reputable dealers. So we'll go out and we'll buy our drugs for our kids. Make sure that the meth that they use is that we go buy it for them, lest they put themselves in danger by visiting a neighborhood with a meth lab or going into a meth lab. Wouldn't want anything to happen there. Let's make sure that the meth that they have is as safe as it can possibly be. Yes. That's called giving up as a parent. Ann calls from Crestwood. Hi, Ann.
Hi, good afternoon. Well, I was thinking about how they're going to distribute these condoms, and I was thinking of, like, when I was growing up, I'm picturing people waiting in lines for them, maybe, and thinking how ashamed or embarrassed or you would have felt years ago. And now it just seems like we're very tacky and shameless and happy to be infamous, if it comes to that.
Well, yeah. You're right. The stigma, is that what we're really talking about here?
Oh, we just would have been mortified to be seen by somebody if we were waiting. I don't know how they're going to distribute these condoms, but I was just thinking back to when I would have been 20 or something and how embarrassed you would have been to have someone see you doing such a thing. I mean, it was bad enough buying feminine hygiene products, but this is just, we have no shame whatsoever in America anymore. We've become tacky America. It used to be the ugly American. Now we're the tacky America.
Well, and I actually saw the video of the CNN story that we ran, and as far as I can tell from the video, I might be wrong here, but they put them in giant bowls, and they put them on the bar at the club.
Oh, geez.
That's how they're distributed.
Okay.
You know, if I were a condom manufacturer, I would be royally perturbed. Because I'm making the thing and selling it, and New York is giving it away free. Yeah, they buy it from the condom manufacturer, but not at the prices I could get at Walgreens. Here's an email. It says, Parents are allowing their kids and friends to get drunk at parties in their home under parental supervision because, quote, well, they're going out and getting drunk anyway, so at least they're drunk here at home where it's safe. Yeah, thank you very much. Again, when you hear it put this way, you realize why try and stop them from doing anything? Is there anything? Because they're going to do fill in the blank. Right? Kids will always find a way to blank, whatever you want it to be. They're going to find a way to play with rattlesnakes. We might as well teach them how to handle rattlesnakes as safely as possible, or have them do their snake handling here at the house where we can supervise it. And this is the logic that I don't want to make you scared, Jeff, because you've got two daughters. Three? How many daughters do you have
now? Yes, but there's still a Lutheran convent in Germany, and that's where both of them will be going.
Okay, so you've got two little girls.
You think I'm kidding?
No, how old are they?
You think I'm kidding?
How old are the girls?
Emily just turned 7 on February 11th, and Katie just turned 4 on Valentine's Day.
So you have about 5 years. I'll just estimate. 5 years before you stop sleeping at night, pretty much. And I don't think Justin will probably be a good boy. Watch out for be glad you had a boy first, because he will watch out for his sisters and he may be able to deflect a lot of this stuff. You really should get him in the weight room now.
You know, I have a sister that's a year younger than me.
Mm-hmm.
All my friends wanted to date him. I told him that she was gay. I did. They were convinced for years that my sister was gay.
That's a great strategy. I love that. Love it. You might have scarred her for life, though.
I think I did.
But in any event, if you think, I'm naive. I was raised in a family where my parents actually didn't give up. Five boys, by the way. Five boys, and they didn't give up. In the 70s. Five boys, raising five boys in the 70s, and they didn't give up. I thank God for them every day. Now, if they would have said, look, they're going to do this, so they might as well do it at home, or they might as well do it under our supervision or whatever. Well, I remember the drinking age in Texas was 17 when I was in high school. Texas is a very forward-thinking, enlightened state. The drinking age was 17. And my parents never made a big deal out of drinking. And when we were 17, they said, if you want to have a beer, have one here at the house. And don't get in the car. Which was very different from saying the drinking age is 21. If you're going to have a beer, have one here at the house when the kid's 14. There's always another option here. Isn't one of the options always going to be, you know, you don't have to do that. You don't have to play with rattlesnakes. You don't have to take meth. And you don't have to go out and have sex. What do you get when parents give up? Well, New Jersey. This week. Here's the story.
A monumental day in New Jersey, which is now the third state in the nation to allow civil unions between same-sex couples. People begin filing their paperwork, or they did at midnight. Eyewitness News reporter Ken Rosato visited some of these champagne brunches and these celebrations over there after the wedding. How are you, sir?
Big celebrations. A very good afternoon to you, Steve and Lurie. Good afternoon, everybody. Well, hundreds of gay civil union advocates gathered here at the Woodbridge Hilton to celebrate their newly granted right to unite.
Three, two, one.
It's official. Today marks the first day that gay and lesbian couples in New Jersey can hold legally binding civil union ceremonies. The Garden State is now the third in the nation to recognize such relationships.
When you're gay, you live with it on an everyday basis. You don't really think about it. You know it's there. And so you don't say to yourself, oh, I feel, you know, like I don't have my rights, because you're living your life the best you can.
Some town halls in New Jersey opened at midnight for partners who wanted to be among the first to file their paperwork. Gay couples wanting a civil union must wait at least 72 hours from when they submit their applications, the same as heterosexual couples filing for marriage. As for the hundreds of couples now living in New Jersey who previously held civil unions in other places where they're deemed legal, those relationships are now automatically considered binding here. To celebrate, hundreds of people involved in supporting the passage of this legislation gathered at the Woodbridge Hilton today for a champagne brunch.
We haven't registered yet. We're going to have our civil union on March 9th, which will be 38 years to the day that we first met.
I'm allowed to bless cats, dogs, houses, bathrooms, bells, but I'm not supposed to bless people and their relationship together. And I'm looking forward to the day when that even changes within our own church.
And that last gentleman is Pastor Bob Kreisat. He and his partner, whom you saw just before, been together 38 years, are going to have their union blessing, or their civil union, as it's now called here legally in the state of New Jersey, come March. And they say that while they're very happy that this is now a legal process in the state of New Jersey, they are looking forward to the day that this can be called a marriage. That's it from here. We're live in Woodbridge, New Jersey. Ken Rosado, Channel 7.
It's not going to stop, because we're told, instead of marriage, let's just let them have civil unions. And what's the last thing we heard there? They're looking forward to the day when this can be called a marriage. Not until, through that term marriage, full societal legitimacy is granted, will those who are advocating for gay marriage be truly happy. And I wonder if they'll even be happy then. We don't know. We'll probably find out. You know what the court did here in New Jersey? The legislature and the court, they said, hey, they're going to live together. They're going to live as though they're married. Anyway, we might as well make it legal. That last guy they interviewed, the pastor in the church who'd been in a gay relationship for 30 years, probably a Lutheran, said, essentially wants his church to say, we have gay pastors anyway. They're going to go out. Our gay pastors are going to go out and get partners anyway. Let's just say it's okay. He's counting on it. Well, on the same subject, in California, the other coast, gay marriage is making its way up the court ladder.
Robin and Diane knew the outcome of their trip to the Beverly Hills courthouse long before they ever set out. The gay couple came for a marriage license on this Valentine's Day, a license they know in California can only be issued to a man and woman.
There is no reason why our love is worth any less because we happen to be two women.
I want to marry Robin. I'm 53 years old. I want to marry her. I want to spend the rest of my life with her. There's no reason not to do it.
The two women have been fighting for the right to marry for years. Opponents have long maintained that marriage should be the right of a man and a woman, and a recent proposition passed by voters supports that position. But now the fight is going to the state Supreme Court.
In our brief, we argue that an individual enjoys a fundamental constitutional right to marry, and that right includes the right to marry the person of one's choice.
Robin and Diane have been doing this now for 6 years on Valentine's Day. They're hoping now that their case is before the Supreme Court, this year will be the last.
I'm thrilled that we're going to the Supreme Court. I sincerely hope that next year we can come here. When we win, if we win and get married, we are going to come here anyway.
The fight over gay marriage is moving out of the hands of voters and into the hands of judges. The state Supreme Court could have the final say over who can say I do.
This is John Gregory reporting.
All right, that's the story from California again. Did you hear what the women in question there were saying? If you listen carefully to how they state their position, before they get around to saying something like, we have a right to get married, which is, that's a legal question, isn't it? Before they said that, what they said was, I want to. The woman said, I want to marry Robin. I want to do this. I want to do this. There's no reason why I shouldn't. Put those words in the mouth of a 4-year-old. I want a cookie. I want my cookie now. There's no reason why I shouldn't have my cookie. And there is the courts, kind of like the parent who says, well, he's going to sneak cookies anyway. I wish I would have had that argument when I was a teenager. I could have gotten away with anything If my parents would have bought the argument, my parents are far too smart for that. But if they would have bought the argument, hey, I'm going to go do it anyway. I'm going to go do it anyway. You might as well let me. You might as well, Dad, come on, Dad. I'm going to go smoke weed anyway. You might as well pay for it. It's audio open lines issues, etc. I want to hear from you. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Email us issuesetc@kfuo.org. Here's Tim calling from his car. Hi, Tim.
Hi. As a parent, I find that it's virtually impossible nowadays with where society is to everybody on TV is, I mean, do you tell your kid it's wrong to watch Ellen DeGeneres, it's wrong to listen to Elton John songs, you know, all these game shows, Deal or No Deal, they're on in there with these micro mini skirts, this is the way they dress, the stars like Britney Spears and all these, you know, Paris Hilton. It's just overwhelming. How do you address this with your children?
Well, you might not agree with me, Tim, but I want my daughter to see Britney Spears meltdown. I want her to see what it looks like when someone simply does what they darn well please 24/7 without anyone telling them no. You know what eventually happens? They consume themselves.
I can see where they see that, but don't you think there's also an allure, though? Because you see all these people, and they also have the money, and they also have the fame, and they also have the good-looking boyfriend.
Well, that's true, Tim, and thank you for the call. We got someone waiting here. Yeah, but she could have all those things without melting down. This is a result of no one having told her for about the last decade, no, Brittany, don't do that. You don't tell your kid the stove is hot, they will touch it. And they'll burn themselves. It's a big question that Tim asked. What do you do with your kids? Well, first of all, we don't put our heads in the sand and say, I can somehow manage to keep my child from being exposed to any of these things. You can't. What you can do is teach them that what they're being the right and the wrong of what they're being exposed to. And that doesn't happen when they turn teenagers. It happens the day you bring them home from the hospital. That's where it starts. And it doesn't end. This is what annoys me about a lot of Christian parents. If I get them to about age 10 and I've taught them all these things and I've catechized them, then they just kind of coast. No, they don't. At age 10, the real hard work begins. That's when you really have to be the fierce protector of your children. I've told my daughter 100 times, if I've told her once, it's my job to keep you from killing yourself in one form or another. And I take that job very seriously, and I don't care if you like the way I do my job or not. I'm going to do it. It's my job. Tomorrow on Issues, Etc., Ash Wednesday and Lent with Pastor Phil Zielinski of Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. When we come back from this break, right in the middle of the program, Nancy Gibbs, editor-at-large from Time Magazine, joins us. She's written the cover story of this week's Time, the abortion campaign you never heard about. We're going to talk about crisis pregnancy centers. And then we'll be joined by Nancy Krauss and Darin Dragon to talk about crisis pregnancy centers for a few more minutes. Audio open lines will follow that. The question I'm laying on the table for audio open lines, why do pastors allow teachings and teachers into their church that contradict their church's doctrine? We'll be right back.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
We owe our thanks to the gospel writer Luke for that story of those two men who walked on the road to Emmaus with Jesus but did not recognize him. It's found in Luke 24, and we'll talk about it next time on the Bible Study with Pastor Alan Shade of Emmanuel Lutheran Church in St. Charles. Then at 11 o'clock, we have Lenten worship from Peace Lutheran Church in South County.
The Bible Study on AM 850 KFUO is underwritten by Concordia Christian Books and Gifts, serving God's people.
On the next Focus on the Family, special guest Dr. Harold Davis reminds men that we need to rise up and confront our culture.
It's very important in our homes, fathers, that we teach our kids how to destroy evil. And it's very important that they see us get angry about evil.
It's a message that's sure to inspire and challenge the men of the church. That's next time on Focus on the Family.
Weekdays at 9:30 on AM 850 KFUO.
This is Family News in Focus. I'm Terry Phillips, sitting in for Bob Dittmer. NARAL Pro-Choice America is once again after the nation's largest retailer. The powerful abortion advocate was first able to force Walmart to carry the abortion drug, Plan B. Now NARAL has in its sight Walmart pharmacists who refuse to dispense the drug on moral grounds. Steve Jordahl reports that's intolerant for a group that calls itself Pro-Choice America.
An email went out recently to NARAL's mailing list from someone named Tanisha Boyd. She claims when she and her boyfriend went to Walmart after their condom failed, the pharmacist laughed in their faces and refused to serve them. Jan LaRue of Concerned Women for America says it smells like a NARAL fundraising ploy to her.
I expect this whole campaign by NARAL to be filed appropriately in that infamous circular file we all maintain.
NARAL is urging a letter-writing campaign to Walmart to pressure them to change their policies. It was only a year ago that the abortion champion pressured Walmart into carrying the drug. Kerry Gordon Earle says if NARAL is really pro-choice, it should act like it.
The question is this really about choice? Because if it's really about choice, what about the choice of the pharmacist?
In a written statement, Walmart says it maintains its conscientious objection policy, which allows any pharmacy associate who does not feel comfortable dispensing the product to refer customers to another pharmacist to complete the sale. Bo Kuhar is with Pharmacists for Life.
Pharmacists should be fully confident that they don't need to park their morals and beliefs at the door, just like most other professions don't have to.
If you want to tell Walmart you support pharmacist choice, call them at 1-800-WALMART. For Family News in Focus, I'm Steve Jordahl.
If NARAL can get Walmart to fold, smaller retailers will most likely fall into line. NARAL did not return repeated calls for comment. For Family News in Focus, I'm Terry Phillips.
Most of us realize that it is inappropriate to tell our children that we will love them if they obey us and not argue with us. Yet when it comes to our relationship with God, is it not true that we assume God will keep us as His children when we obey Him and not argue with Him? That is the subject for discussion on the next Law and Gospel.
Listen to Law and Gospel weekday afternoons from 1 till 3 on AM 850 KFUO. Concordia Publishing House and Issues Etc. are pleased to offer our Book of the Month for February titled A Seminary in Crisis. It's a history book that you won't be able to put down. A Seminary in Crisis tells the story about the battle for the Bible in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod in the early 1970s. For more information, call Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040, or visit our website, issuesetc.org. The book, A Seminary in Crisis.
Defending life from beginning to end. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. We're going to be joined here in just a moment by Nancy Gibbs. She has authored the cover story of Time Magazine's latest called The Abortion Campaign You Never Heard About. Nancy Gibbs is editor-at-large for Time Magazine. Our call-in number is 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727 or email us here in the studio, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Nancy, welcome to Issues Etc.
Hi, Todd. Nice to be with you.
How do we account for what appears to be a rising number of crisis pregnancy centers in the U.S.?
Well, you know, it's a number that's been going up pretty steadily over the decade. So I think, you know, maybe what's rising is more the attention that's being paid to them because much more money and I think thought is going into their marketing. CareNet alone spent $4 million marketing their centers last year because, you know, the important thing was for women to know that these services were available. I think it may be that as they come more on the radar screen, it seems as though there are more of them, but I think what in fact it may be as much as anything is more awareness of them. But I think in either case, it is because of a change in emphasis into looking at what is it that would drive a woman to have an abortion in the first place and what kind of intervention might prevent that decision from taking place. And the more understanding there is of the motives, the more ability there is for these centers to say, okay, if we can change the dynamic, maybe we can change the decision.
So these centers have in the past come in for quite a bit of criticism from pro-choice organizations for kind of have strong-arm tactics or manipulative things like that. Does it appear, if those things are true, does it appear that the crisis pregnancy centers are becoming more savvy in the way that they deal with a woman who is in a crisis pregnancy situation?
They are. If you look at the training manuals that the national organizations offer to volunteers, they're very clear about why the sort of heavy-handed confrontational tactics are, you know, whether or not you can argue that they're unscriptural, but they are tactically unwise as well. That if the goal of the counselor is to sort of open up a line of communication, make a connection with the woman, then a sort of, you know, either any kind of an economic or political or theological confrontation is probably not the best way to do that. And so what the national leadership says is the centers really have become much more professional in their training and in their studies about what tends to work to get women to feel comfortable in these centers and feel like they can open up and really explore what's on their minds and what they might be weighing in their decision about their pregnancy, and that tends to be a much more fruitful way to go than some of the tactics that were used in the past, and I think are probably much less common now.
Is it true that crisis pregnancy centers, as far as we can count them, because accounting is a little difficult, actually outnumber abortion clinics in the U.S.?
It is true. Even, you know, there are a lot that it's hard to count because there's some that aren't affiliated with any of the national organizations like NIFLA or Heartbeat or CareNet. But even the ones that are part of the national affiliates, there are more of them than there are abortion providers. Now, again, the thing that's tricky about that is how you count abortion providers. There can be doctors who will perform abortions as part of their practice but not advertise themselves as providers or announce that they are not abortion clinics. And so I think all of these numbers are a little tricky to pin down. But it certainly wouldn't surprise me to see that there are more crisis pregnancy centers than there are, certainly than there are abortion clinics in the strictest sense.
As far as we can tell, are the number of abortion clinics on the decline?
Yes, and although the interesting thing in this, in each case, has to do with the distribution in a way more than the numbers. There are a woman in Wyoming, I think, who wants to get an abortion is likely to go to Colorado, whereas yet there are, I think, 8 or 10 crisis pregnancy centers in the state. In some rural states, there will be many more crisis pregnancy centers than there are abortion providers. But the effort now is to crisis pregnancy centers in the urban areas and college campuses and areas that tend to have much higher frequency of abortion among the populations there.
Are you finding it? I noticed early in your article you even quote presidential candidate and New York Senator Hillary Clinton describing abortion as in negative terms, although she's still pro-choice. Are you finding it harder to find political leaders who will come out and say abortion is a social good, a good thing, even pro-choice leaders?
I don't know that. I mean, that's such an interesting question. I don't know if anyone would have come out and said, you know, I think it's a good thing for women to have abortions. I don't know that that was ever. I mean, that would be such a strange thing. I think that there were certainly, though, I mean, even groups like Planned Parenthood will say that abortion is a really small percentage of what they see their clients for. It's less than 10% of the services they provide are abortion-related services. The vast majority, 9 out of 10 people who are seen at a Planned Parenthood clinic, they say, are coming for other reproductive health, for information on family planning or on birth control, on sexually transmitted diseases, for pap smears, for all kinds of other services. And yet Planned Parenthood is so associated because I think so much of their public comment has been about abortion, and so they become seen as being an organization that is primarily about abortion, when in fact they were always primarily about family planning. And, you know, their argument has been the way to reduce abortion is for women who aren't wanting to be pregnant and who might consider having an abortion not to get pregnant in the first place, and then you could reduce abortion dramatically. So I think, I'm not sure that there ever were a lot of politicians, certainly, who were arguing that, you know, that abortion is a good thing. I think, and yet I think it was easy for the debate to sound that way. And what politicians are realizing is that if they think abortion is a tragedy, if they realize that a woman facing a pregnancy she hadn't planned on is under enormous pressure, very often economic pressure, family pressure, emotional pressure, all kinds of stress that can be just horribly painful and difficult, that none of the choices is going to be easy. You know, it isn't easy to give up a baby for adoption. It isn't easy to have an abortion. It isn't easy to raise a child if you feel like your life really does not allow you to make the kind of commitment of time and resources that a baby must and needs to have. And so once there's an understanding that none of these choices is an easy one, then you can have the conversation of, okay, how do we support these women, support these families, help all women for their families make the healthiest, wisest, best choices for them. And so that's a long way away, and that's what has someone like Hillary Clinton saying abortion is a tragedy for many women, and that her goal is the day when it's a right. I mean, she obviously believes it should still be, women should have a legal right to obtain one, but that it should be a right that women never have to exercise.
How did some of the pro-choice leaders that you interviewed for your piece, how did they react to the rising prominence and the growth of crisis pregnancy centers?
You know, it's an interesting reaction, because I think what frustrates them most, I mean, I think that many of them will say, in fact, you know, one of the abortion providers I talked to said, you know, I routinely turn away women, and I've heard abortion providers say this before, they turn away women who they think may be being pressured to get the abortion by a boyfriend, by a husband, by parents, and they are grateful to be able to send a woman to a place that will help her handle a pregnancy that she hadn't planned for, that they're grateful that this resource is there, on the one hand. On the other hand, they express real concern about the information that's given, and as you know, among the abiding arguments is about medical risks, the issue of psychological fallout from abortion, what is it that women should be told and in what terms and based on what evidence when they're trying to weigh a decision between going through with a pregnancy and terminating a pregnancy. And so where the criticism tends to come in from the pro-choice side is what information is being given, and an argument over trying to prevent the pregnancies in the first place and the need for a different approach to pregnancy prevention. Those tend to be the fault lines. I don't think that I haven't heard any criticism of, you know, the effort to minister to women who are in crisis and to try to sort of wrap them up in a spirit of love and support that makes them feel less desperate, less alone, less overwhelmed by their circumstances.
It sounds as though the parent organizations of the crisis pregnancy centers understand that their information needs to be absolutely 100% accurate, only for the sake of their own credibility.
Oh, absolutely. And you know, this is what I talked to a fascinating Evangelical Presbyterian minister in North Carolina, who's part of a group that is, you know, sort of, you know, about a half a dozen very ardent pro-lifers and a half a dozen ardent pro-choicers who meet monthly to talk about these issues and to figure out, you know, what can we do together to help women? How can we help families? Do we have any common ground? Even acknowledging that they're not likely to change each other's minds on sort of basic questions of when does life begin. But one of the things he said is, he said, you know, it is so hard to even agree on what should count as the gold standard for medical information. If you're not a scientist, I'm not a scientist, I'm a journalist, you know, if he's a minister, someone else is a volunteer counselor. If you're not yourself a scientist, then how do you know that you are delivering and acting on the best, most authoritative scientific information? And this is, you know, this has been a real challenge on any number of issues, and this is certainly one of them. There is tremendous argument over the issue of whether there's a breast cancer, an increased breast cancer risk with abortion, whether about the risks of infection and other potential medical complications from abortion, a tremendous argument over the notion of post-abortion syndrome and what the emotional fallout of abortion is. And the literature, as you know, is vast. And, you know, I think what's difficult is, what would count as having something be settled? There will always be more studies. There will always be another study that might come down, you know, on one point on the spectrum or another. And so, you know, on the issue of the breast cancer link, when the National Cancer Institute, which, you know, generally this country will treat as, you know, a gold standard source, has a conference to try to study all of the literature, all of the surveys that have been done on a breast cancer link, and concludes that there isn't one, does that mean that that question should be considered settled, or does that mean, well, no, there's more research, or no, maybe their decision was the result of political pressure? It's as though the question never does get settled. And so I think that is a real challenge for people on all sides of this debate, to be confident that they are being very careful about the information that they are giving.
Finally, Nancy, with only about 30 seconds, were you surprised that this issue was deemed important enough to make the cover of Time magazine?
Well, it's hard for me to answer that since I was the one who argued that it should be on the cover. And, and you know, any time where a lot of the people that I was talking with knew very little about these centers, were not aware of what they were doing, how many they were, I think what an important part of the landscape for these women, what an important role they were playing. And so I thought that was a very important story to tell. I was glad to have been able to get the space to tell the story and to let people really talk and argue with each other and express their point of view, because this is, as you know very well, this is a subject that people have passionate feelings about. So.
Nancy Gibbs is editor-at-large for Time magazine. She's authored this week's cover story in Time, The Abortion Campaign You Never Heard About. Nancy, thank you very much for being our guest.
Thank you.
You can read this article, The Abortion Campaign You Never Heard About, at time.com, time.com. Well, for the next few minutes, we're joined by Dr. Janice Krause. We're going to continue the conversation on crisis pregnancy centers. Dr. Krause is a senior fellow for the Beverly LaHaye Institute at Concerned Women for America. Janice, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Thank you, Todd. It's great to be with you.
Looking at the Time magazine cover story, what's your general reaction?
Well, I'm really pleased to see that a national magazine with the kind of circulation that Time has an article of such interest to Americans. I think it's one of the pivotal issues of today, certainly the moral issue of our time in many respects. So I'm very pleased to see them cover it. I think it was a very balanced article. And so I was very pleased with the way Nancy handled it and the way the article came out, and very, very pleased to see it as the cover story.
Is this kind of the, best kept secret of the pro-life movement, the crisis pregnancy centers and the number of these things nationwide?
I think it is. I wrote an article in 2003 that was featured in Touchstone magazine called Unsafe, Deadly, and Legal. And in there I pointed out that the number of abortion clinics had decreased by 40% between 1998, and that the crisis pregnancy centers were going up, that in 1980 there were only 500, and then in the year 1990 there were 2,000, and now they're over 4,000. So in 2003, that was in a major article, and yet it did not catch on with the public for some reason, and was not, I don't think, generally well known across the nation.
Why are abortion clinics, on the number of them, on the decline?
I think primarily because of the increases in technology. When you have 3D and 4D sonograms and people actually see a baby blinking its eyes, seeing the hands open and close, seeing it suck its mouth, suck its tongue, suck its thumb, I think people recognize at an emotional level that that really is a baby. And I think the surgery where the little hand came out and grasped the hand of the doctor, I think that was, both of those instances were things that really touched the public's heart and I think had a dramatic impact on the way people viewed abortion.
I got to ask you about this story that's been all over the news this week. And the pictures are stunning. Smallest baby is what the headlines were reading. This little 10-ounce baby. Strike me when I saw the picture. This is the very point at which many children are aborted, and this baby's going home from the hospital. Your thoughts on it?
I think those kinds of images really have dramatic impact. You know, you can cite the figures, you can talk about the trends, you can talk about the moral aspects. All of those things very definitely, you know, influence people. But when it comes to actually changing people's minds and causing them to do a direct turnaround, it's primarily based on emotion, and nobody can look at those pictures of those tiny little feet that are on the front page of the Drudge website and not be tremendously moved emotionally to see that tiny little baby no longer than a ballpoint pen fighting for its life. And I think those kinds of images really strike at people's hearts and make a difference in the way they feel.
Now, I would like you to respond, if you could, in a general way, to the criticisms that some of them are found in the Time magazine article being voiced by pro-choice leaders, the criticisms of the crisis pregnancy centers that they don't provide accurate information or they provide outdated information or that they strong-arm either through kind of overtly religious or just kind of generally a judgmental means a woman who comes to them in a crisis situation. How do you respond to that generally?
Hogwash, basically. I mean, even Nancy contradicted that point of view. She talked about them in very positive terms about their professionalism and the way they relied on very substantive research and so forth. So I think the criticisms of the CPCs are very much outdated because they are looking at some of the early attempts. All of us are much more well-informed today than we were even 5 years ago and most certainly 10 years ago in terms of the research. And the strong-arm tactics have always been the behavior of the minority and the far, far, far extremists. They were not the behavior of the majority of people who were quite concerned about what was happening in the abortion clinics. There have always been people who silently prayed across the street from abortion clinics, who talked with people one-on-one. So I think the judgmentalism and so forth very definitely is a thing of the past and was greatly exaggerated even in the past.
I also, in reading the Time magazine story, became curious about, how do I say this, the appeal for the pro-life community of a crisis pregnancy center as a venue, as a target for their money and their concern and their support. What is it about having a crisis pregnancy center in a community, a small town, a city, wherever it may be, that you think especially appeals to someone who is pro-life minded?
I think because it provides a place to be able to send someone where you know they're going to be getting accurate information, where they're going to be accepted and have an opportunity to think through their circumstances with someone who is a stranger to them for the most part. Because if you're talking with a parent, that's an emotionally laden situation. A pastor, the same thing. Many instances, those are wonderful places to go for counseling and for support. But in some other instances, it's much better to talk to a stranger. And the CPCs, the crisis pregnancy centers, are well-trained. They know how to look at a situation in very realistic ways. They understand the emotions that the girl is going through. They want to help, and they provide a place for her to bear her soul and to be sure that she's going to get unbiased, very fair advice.
One of the issues that was raised in the timepiece has to do with the shift in power in Washington, D.C., with the Democratic Party, largely perceived as pro-choice, now taking the reins of power in the legislature for a while. What do you think this will mean for crisis pregnancy centers?
Well, it's hard to say. I think for the public in general, it's going to mean much more acceptance of the pro-life position, because every single politician is having to come to the center, not necessarily in their true beliefs and their ideology, but certainly in their rhetoric, because it's very out of the times to speak in extreme terms and to be harsh in your rhetoric about a pro-choice position. Always the very phrase pro-choice has been a very attractive one for the public, because nobody likes to be seen as judgmental. But having the crisis pregnancy centers is a place that's not connected with the church usually. It's not connected with a particular religious faith, but people know that they are conservative. They know that they're going to be presented with a moral point of view, but they also know that it's going to be a dispassionate point of view. And I think having that attitude is much more prevalent today, and Democrats in Congress and the left in general are going to have to be accepting of that change in public. I think, in general, these value issues are more cultural than they are political. And when you see a change in the culture, the politicians are going to have to follow that. And you can't really make a change the other way around, you know, with the politicians imposing their will on the public and the public having to accept that. Instead, I think it's much more powerful when you have a shift in the culture and the politicians have to come along. And I think that's what we're seeing now.
With only 30 seconds before our break, Janet, have we turned a corner in that there are many advocates for choice who are now openly saying, sometimes to the chagrin of their fellow pro-choicers, that abortion is not a good thing. It may be a tragedy. Some are even say, yeah, it is a taking of a life. And then they're kind of making the argument from necessity. But getting the pro-choice leaders to admit that abortion is not a good thing, is that a milestone?
That is a milestone, but they've always said that. You know, they've always said we want to make abortion safe, legal, and rare. But it's not necessarily safe or rare. And I think what we're hearing is a change in the rhetoric. But we must keep our eye on the number of abortions. There still are way too many abortions, and we must change that number. And I think the cultural shift is what's making that change, and politicians are coming along, and that's a good thing.
CWFA.org is the website address for Concerned Women for America. CWFA.org. Dr. Janice Krause is Senior Fellow for the Beverly LaHaye Institute at Concerned Women for America. Thank you for being our guest.
It's my pleasure, Todd.
Well, when we come back, we're going to stay on this subject, and we're going to get an inside look at crisis pregnancy centers. Dorinda Dragon is going to be our guest. She's president of the Central Indiana Crisis Pregnancy Centers, and we'll find out what's it like there at the grassroots, on the front lines, of what Time Magazine is calling a campaign, an abortion campaign you never heard about, the battle over abortion. And then, after a short conversation with Dorinda, we're going to open up the phone lines for your questions and your comments. I got a question laid on the table. I want you thinking about it in the meantime. We did a little review of Beth Moore yesterday. I got a couple emails to read in regard to that. But it doesn't surprise me that the Baptist Church would have Beth Moore books and simulcasts and satellite appearances, because her theology is essentially Baptist theology. But what about churches and congregations that don't have a Baptist theology? Why do Lutheran, Presbyterian, Catholic churches have teachers in that contradict their teaching? We'll be right back.
Defending life from beginning to end. You're listening to Issues Etc.